Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
You're tuning into an episode of the Redefining Society podcast, hosted by Marco Cappelli. Let's face it, the future is now. We live in a hybrid analog digital society, and we must stop ignoring it or pretending that technology is not affecting us. The line between the physical and virtual worlds has become a figment of our imagination. On it, we are continually performing a dangerous balancing act, juggling convenience, privacy, freedom, security, technology, society, culture, and even the future of humanity. There is no better place than here, and no better time than now to muse on our relationship with technology and how to redefine what society means in this new age.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impacts of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
Hello, everybody. This is Marco Cappelli. Welcome to another episode of Redefining Society podcast. And as you know, we're always redefining society. That's the name. And when I finish to redefine it, I got to start all over again because we're moving really, really fast, especially lately. And especially, I like to say, in the past year, since when we had, everybody have discovered that there is a generative AI and a lot of people are playing with it and somebody is scared of it. Somebody is a little bit more excited. So we'll see where we go today. Because our conversation is going to be, I think, a little bit philosophical in terms of humanity and machines, and maybe we'll go into robotics, maybe we'll go into personalization of a little bit of this and a little bit of that, because at this point, as you know, everything is technology. And we're going to do this with my guest today, Sid Mohaseb. I don't know if I Italianize enough your last name, but I tried, and I'm excited about having this conversation. I love your pitch, the point that you are interested in talking about. So I am looking forward about this conversation, and I want to start with you introducing yourself, because I'm not good at reading other people's bio. So, and nobody knows yourself better than you, I guess. I don't know. You can go as philosophical as you like to define yourself, too. Let's get it started. The meaning of life. Who is Sid?
So good morning and good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, as they say.
Yeah.
I'm an immigrant in the U.S. I came to the States in about 40-some-odd years ago, and at the age of 16. And started a business while I was in college. That was my first business. After I sold that business, I started a consulting career, and I helped really large organizations, the types of IBMs and Motorolas and Federal Reserve Banks and others, with strategy and operations. And then I became a partner of that firm and felt, hey, I'm on this side making money on an hourly basis. Maybe I should, I could do better. So I got into turnarounds of companies and leveraged buyouts. And that kind of started the whole new career of building companies and selling companies. And I did that for quite a while. with some successes and some failures. And eventually I became a venture investor, making investments in early stage companies. Now, that's kind of me in the context of what others would call success. And you know, there's I say there's success is what others define you by. Satisfaction is what really drives you. So from a satisfaction perspective, if you would, I believe, and I have a couple of books and stuff like that that I talk about, like entrepreneurship. And I define entrepreneurship in a different way. The first time entrepreneur was defined as a word was by a Frenchman. He said that the entrepreneur is a person who has something and exchanges it something for something better. 50 years later, somebody added, an Irishman added an element of risk and says somebody who has something, this could be an idea, this could be your time, this could be your product, whatever it is, and you exchange it with something better, knowing that there is risk. So I like to think of myself as an entrepreneur, not because I started companies, but because I was an entrepreneur when I came to the U.S. by myself at 16. I had something, and I wanted to exchange it for something better.
I love that. I love that.
And I think we all do that. We're all entrepreneurs. If we really truly go to the roots of the definition of what an entrepreneur is, I think Martin Luther King is an entrepreneur, because he exchanged his ideas and his resources and his capabilities with in pursuit of something bigger. I think Mother Teresa was an entrepreneur. I think Michelangelo was an entrepreneur. And so is Elon Musk. But they are all exchanging their time and interest and creativity, innovation, or money with something else.
I love that because it's a little bit what we talked about before starting the recording. Like, everybody has somebody to sell. That's what we're talking. And that's okay, because every time that we interact with someone, we are selling our opinion, maybe. We're selling ourselves. We're showing that we're capable of something. So your definition of being an entrepreneur, it's definitely a lot more satisfying, I guess, than base success on money, which is something, unfortunately, in our modern society.
Yeah,
we do. How did you get, I'm assuming it's because you're investing in company. Every company now is a technology company. So my question is, where does your passion for technology come from?
So I guess I was, for years before my father passed away, I went to USC. I now teach there, but I went to USC, University of Southern California, again, a long time ago. And I studied something called operations research. And for years, my father said, I don't understand what the hell you studied. But nowadays, it's pretty sexy because it's called data science. In those days, it was just this confused thing. So
it's still confusing for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's the mystique. That's how you position it so you can ask for more money. I don't know. So I got into operations research. And then later on, I've built a number of companies based in technology. The last company that I sold was a few years back to KPMG, as you know, it's a big firm, which did analytics on text and what's called unstructured data. And that place is now, that company was the seed of KPMG's Lighthouse, which is now about 2,000 people, and I joined them. And so all of my companies, everything that I've done, has had an element of technology in it. So I wouldn't say, in the past 20, 30 years, I haven't coded one line of code. So I wouldn't say I am a technologist, but I am fascinated with whatever can make our life better. And technology is something that can make our life better. if we use it right. I use the analogy nowadays, this ChatGPT and AI and all the hoopla that's going on. And people are afraid. You know, when you look at some of the statistics, somewhere around 60-some% of people are absolutely afraid, and another 17-18% are kind of afraid. That makes 78% of the population that are afraid of AI. If we could do the same thing and be afraid of a knife, because it could cut us, but can you imagine how life would be without a knife?
You have to hammer stuff to cut it, to break it.
Yeah, it would be difficult. So the key is everything could be very scary if our perspective and our ability to use that is questioned.
Yeah, I agree. Let me get to that. So your title idea for our conversation is AI and the future, people versus machine. So, I mean, what you just said, that just right there. Is it a people versus machine, or is it people with machines, an augmented maybe version of ourselves? And, you know, so let's just dive into that.
Yes. So if you listen to the media today, it's people versus machine because it gets clicks.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you fear is a motivator for people to click, and then that adds to advertising and blah, blah. Let's be honest. People don't have the patience for an intellectual conversation about what is this and how is that. You know, we read 10-second things, and Google has taught us that in 8 seconds we have to be satisfied.
Yeah, with the headline
some
is enough.
So basically... I wrote a book in 2017. It was published, so that's 7 years ago. And one of the chapters is be a partner with the machine, and where I talked about, hey, this is AI thing coming. Here's what's gonna happen. We can't. So what do we do? So we are afraid. Should we not cure cancer because we're scared of machines, and because we can now process things significantly faster than we could before. So some processing things with quantum computing can be done in seconds that would have taken years. So we should not do it, because then what's going to happen if we use it? Imagine how many people are in the healthcare business. How many of them are going to be out of a job? So should we preserve those jobs and not cure diseases? Yeah. Well, to some people, that may be an answer. And some people say, hey, I just care about the next few years that I'm alive. I don't care after that. Whatever they do, they do. So it becomes a very selfish perspective, if you would.
It's the same thing about the environment, for example, right? I mean, do we want to lose those jobs, or do we want to save the planet that we, by the way, contributed to screw up? So really good point right there.
So the fear is, Marco, the fear is very personal and selective and selfish. And that is because our domain of our view is often limited. Meaning that I care about, I have a wife, I have kids, I have to buy... go to grocery store and buy things and feed them and pay for the rent and all that. And hey, if I'm a writer now at the show and on TV, or I'm working with a member of a UAW and working for a car company, what do I do if all of this stuff happens and I'm out of a job? It's real. It's personal. Yeah. But the key is that, hey, if you step back and you look at it as, hey, what would have happened if there wasn't any knife? What would have happened if there wasn't any calculator? What would have happened if there was all of those stuff have made our life easier, better, more productive? I mean, the fact that we have a great life, for example, in the United States, a lot of it is due to automation, where productivity went up, we could earn more, we could do more, and all that. So what we lose is perspective of time and perspective of what we have versus what we gain in short term and long term. Is the fear real? Absolutely, it's real. But it's partly because it's positioned that way, partly because we're unprepared. So let me ask you something. Let's fast forward something. We're 30 years from now, 40 years from now, and cars are all self-driving. Okay, you're in your car. A lot of the jobs that you were doing is being done by AI. So what do? You sit in the back of your car and what, play with Facebook or Instagram all the time? Everybody is an influencer pushing some sort of a product. What do? How do we fill our time? So yeah. My point is, and this is where you said I may get philosophical, I believe that we are at a cusp, at a very early stages of a fundamental evolution in humankind. Because we don't have to deal with the mundane. We don't have to deal with a lot of stuff that took a lot of time out of us. We are entering an area where our mind is going. So up to this point, we have physically evolved. Our body, our way. Now it's another era where we can mentally evolve, where we have to be more creative, more innovative. The AI stuff is all about machine learning in the past. Our creativity is all about the future and what we can do. Now, are we ready for that?
Yeah, that's the question. Not today.
Will we get ready for it? Likely, the world would force us to do that.
Well, you know, so I love where you're going. I mean, I wrote pieces, newsletter about this and how I can see the future being an augmented future. And, you know, we live as long as we live, we cure, as you said at the beginning, the diseases that we cure. And you look at CES just ended, the consumer technology. There are stuff this year that it's incredible in every field. I mean, people that can walk again because exoskeleton. There is optimization of agriculture, all using AI, which may be a little bit of a buzzword, but it is a big revolution, a big innovation. It's probably as big as the invention of the computer itself in terms of digital revolution, and then now it's the fourth, the fifth revolution, whatever they want to call it. The industrial revolution was the first one. I am with you from a sociological and philosophical level that I don't think we're ready. And I'm just going to be provocative here. Like our educational system, our new system, the example that you made, if you're writing and presenting and starting with fear, it is not going to work. If you say, no, I don't want to use AI, I don't want my student to use, you're also a professor, I don't want my student to use ChatGPT. Well, they're going to use it anyway. Just teach them how to use it, right? So my fear is, and it was why your first point, it's who should we fear more, people or AI?
So let's drill down into that. So one thing, for example, we have a lot of places in the Congress, in the United States, at the Senate, at people introducing, these are our Congress people, these are our senators, introducing bills that we should not let kids be exposed to the ChatGPT or AI. Now, on the other side of the world, in Hong Kong, there are 420 schools, and they are all providing ChatGPT and AI education. Okay. Yep. So if you want to nationalize this, our perspective, and oh, they may be exposed to a lot of stuff. So I want to ask you one other thing. Let's dig deeper on who should be afraid of. So we have these things in our social media. You are a conservative, I'm a liberal, I'm a conservative, you're a liberal, I have one perspective, I am about environment, you are against environment, you think it's a hoax, I think it's a whatever your position is.
Yeah,
and we go to our social media. Pardon me?
The planet is flat.
Yeah, no, yeah. So we go to our social media circle. It's an Instagram or it's a Facebook or whatever, your Twitter, whatever your choice is. And we have these friends, and as we click, we find people that are like-minded, right? So what we've done is, I talked to some people, for example, they say, everybody thinks like that. Why do they think everybody thinks like that? Because we don't have the patience to read anything. We don't see anything from anybody else. We are in this environment, and your news that's delivered to you is the same news that you clicked 17 times. If you hate Trump, the news that comes to you is about that.
It's an echo chamber of...
So let's fast forward this. Let's fast forward. We're clicking on these things, and as human beings, we have this perspective. We see the world from this set of glasses. This is how we see it. And that's what we're going to teach our children. So we are essentially, by our choices of clicking and choosing and closing, we are creating a world that is polarized, that is compartmentalized. We think we are educating people. We think that the internet, who should we be more afraid of? The machine is just responding to what we want. We are training it to behave this way. And then we say, it's the machine. No, it's us.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Now, well, here's the other thing. Can we blame Facebook for doing it? No, they're an entity that's trying to make money. And we do it. Okay, let's go click on a lot of other things. Let's be open to learn other things. They'll still make money. They don't care what you click on.
Mm-hmm.
They do not care if you look at this ad or that ad. If you look at this or that, they don't.
The way I see Facebook, which I'm not a big fan because of, yeah, they're a company need to make money, but they also been leveraging, and you know, sure, advertising have been doing that all along, leveraging psychology and weakness of people, or, you know, like if we do social engineering in cybersecurity, where we're kind of taking advantage of flaw that we have in our, you know, in our mind, in our brains. But the fact that they've been doing this to the extreme, that they've created a world for many people, that I've heard people say that their internet is Facebook. I mean, their entire internet is Facebook. That's the problem.
This is a sense of responsibility that we as society, we do two things. One is we are a how-to society. Somebody tells us, says, do this way. So we've limited, okay, easy. Everything is a how-to.
Yeah, right? Or you know, black last, or white. Right?
Yeah, it's the last book I wrote. I said, please, if you're looking for a how-to, this is not it. Close this. This book is not for you. I want you to think. I want you to be, provoke yourself. I want you to motivate yourself. Nobody can motivate you. It's not a 2-minute, some guy getting up and say, hey, look what I've done. Look what you can do. No. That's not, that comes from you, within you. You are not them. You are you. No. So what we have done is, what is this how-to thing? And the other is the culture of blame. We blame our parents. We blame our where. Man, we are using these things. Don't click on the same thing. Be prepared to learn more, and it's okay.
No.
But we don't like to do that. I say, why are they doing that? Or this is the other thing. This idea of privacy, and this is my data. Marco, we don't have any problem clicking and getting something for free from Google. We have no problem. We have no problem. How many of us are paying Google a monthly fee? About Facebook? About Instagram? About all the other things that are for free? There is a cost for that. You're exchanging something. Why should a company give you something for free? Would you do that to somebody else?
Yeah.
So there's something you're giving. We give our data to Google. Instead, they give us an 8-second satisfaction of something that we search. And we're perfectly fine with it. We're fine with getting it. But when they say, oh, this is your data, let's get with it. The other thing, now you got me going.
Go.
So the other thing about this,
I did my job right if I got you going.
So let's go. Let's take a look at this data privacy thing. AI is about machine learning. Okay? Machine learning requires something to learn from. Okay? Which is data. So if we don't give it data, it cannot learn anything. And if it cannot learn anything, it's dumb. Okay? So look at the Chinese government and the Chinese approach. They get all the data. Companies share. In Japan, 100 manufacturing companies decided to share their data. They're sharing their data. What that means is they're learning. As they learn, they have the material. You want to build a building? You need concrete. You need iron. You want to build an AI machine? You need data. We are so afraid, so fast forward, we're going to lose competitiveness because all of our stuff that we're doing, all the rules and the regulations are, don't use our data. So somebody knows that I have hemophilia. So what? So what's going to happen?
Do you think
knows that I went to this site? So I did. So what do you want to do with it?
So I talk a lot about this with, let's say, European, or where, you know, the GDPR and the story that I listen all the time, that I hear all the time. This is from, you know, privacy lawyer for big companies, and they're like, yeah, you know, in Europe, we being, you know, partially European, we have a history where privacy was abused before, so we're more sensitive about it. The feeling of privacy is different compared with the United States, where it's still more based on property maybe than privacy. So, but I think in the end, we all come down to being, having the same emotion and feelings, right? And I do feel, to go back to, and somebody may disagree with this, I'm sure a lot of people will, but I go back to what you said, to the media are creating sometimes a problem where a problem there isn't. They're creating a difference where a difference there isn't. Maybe we're freaking out so much about privacy because the media want us to freak out about it. And so they can click and sell and all of that. And I say many times, we need to redefine privacy. And when I say that, I notice that even the expert of privacy, they don't really know how to define privacy anymore.
So have you read this laws that the European just passed? Have you looked at it?
The GDPR or
the new AI regulation?
Oh, the AI Act. Yeah,
Responsibility Act.
Yeah,
this is absolutely heaven for attorneys.
Yeah.
This is like the act.
Very confusing. Let's
give as much money to attorneys as possible.
The three levels of involvement and risk. Yeah, it's pretty.
So you have a loan. Somebody doesn't give you a loan, you can go question the bank and say, why did you open up your entire thing? Show me all of your property in terms of AI and your machines and your machine learning and your data. Who would do that? Nobody. So that's a legal action. You're going to have hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of lawsuits. So they tell you, you can't measure emotion. It's illegal for you to measure face recognition. Why? right? Because this illusion of privacy. Now, I have a solution for it. Whoever uses my data, pay me. I'm perfectly fine.
I know.
Let's create
that's
a bank.
The best. Anybody isn't that the best solution?
You want my data? I click over here as of tomorrow morning. Okay, I'm old. You pay me a penny. You're young and a better consumer. You get 10 cents. I'm perfectly fine.
You know what I heard? I want your opinion on this, and then I have a very important question. So I heard this. You know when they give you a discount on insurance? Yeah. Because they are tracking you, how fast Absolutely. You're going on the car. When
they are another. Paying you for your data, that's what they're doing.
Right? They give you a discount. But then they want to try to keep tracking you even when you're not driving. So eventually they'll know you go to the mall or whatever.
They already
But that's not their business anymore. But if they partner with another company, maybe with the mall itself, and they give me a discount... Maybe I'm okay with that.
Since you got me there, there is an article, a white paper I wrote almost, 12 years ago.
You're not that old.
It's called, 12 years ago, nobody was thinking about this stuff.
Oh, no, okay, yeah.
It's called Framing a Data Monetization Strategy, okay? Mm. And I define different ways that you can monetize your data and how you as a company and how do you partner, how do you syndicate, and how. And that is one of the cases that I've said, okay, here's a company, you do this, okay. Then you could actually, here's the thing. If I know where you're going with your car, not only I can profile you from your risk perspective, and I have insurance, so I've got the Toyota data, and I've got the Tesla data, and I've got, because I'm covering all of them. So I know exactly how the engine, the brakes, the acceleration, the deceleration of all of these different cars work. Is that valuable for improvement for other cars? Of course it is. It is valuable to me when I want to buy a car. Of course it is.
In the long run, certainly, you get a more
when you aggregate car. It, now you have data machine learning and you can learn from it. So my point is this. My point is there is a redefining of what we have done. You're redefining society. By the way, one time I want to talk to you about redefining the business models that we operate in. It's we have to go from profit to reason. Because companies are on the wrong track, and it has always worked like that, but we've been trained to say it's about profit. It's about the reason that people act, okay? Here's the thing. Do I sell you something or do you buy from me? Who has the decision? The buyer has the decision. You make the decision, and you make it based on some reasoning. So it's not about me building this massive sales force and this and that. It's about you.
Yeah, unless it's a monopoly that you have to.
It's about the employee who wants to accept a job.
So I knew this was going to go along, and yes, you will definitely come back. But now that we're in the business, so there's definitely the element of trust, right?
Yep.
I mean, I understand, and we talk a lot about this. If I want an AI assistant that works well for me, I have to give it my knowledge. I have to give my taste, the thing I like to do, the disease that I have, the whatever. If I wanted to do a good job. So I need to trust that the company that I give this information and they give me a service, they're going to keep it for themselves, maybe without reselling this data, right? So you had a point in in the things that you... exchange with me that were possible conversation that kind of got me thinking the size of the companies that we're dealing with. So I got the feeling, and that's the question, that you may be on that side, and I am kind of that side too, where if we have more competition and less big company, we could have the market taking care a little bit more of itself. And, you know, it's the capitalist dream, let's say, let the market fix itself. But when you got so big, like Facebook big, Google big, telecom big, then, you know, you need the regulation to step in. And I don't know if they're doing a good job at it. They're trying. Maybe European are doing a little bit better of a job. But this idea of smaller company in tech that compete in a more ethical way, ideally, that would be a nice a nice piece of utopia, but so, how?
So as I started explaining, I've advised many companies at their executive levels, big companies. I've also started and make investments in very small companies. What I think, and I've got articles about this in Time and in Newsweek and stuff, I think we've gone from capitalism to elitism. Let's think of it this way. You have a donut shop. You have a restaurant. You have a small shop somewhere selling, I don't know, TV, whatever it is. If you make a bad decision, your business would not do well. You go into your savings and as an owner, and you pay for it, and there is a consequence. So entrepreneurship and capitalism is about owning your decisions. You make a decision, you win, you take a risk, you lose. Now, if you get big, for example, Delta, we had an issue with Delta. All of a sudden, we, the taxpayers, have to pay them because they made a bad decision. Yeah. Why? Can I? Would the citizen of this thing, I have a donut shop, I made a bad decision, come and give me money? No, that's not the case.
They're not going to bail you out.
Nobody would bail me out. Okay? So this is, so you've got the big problem is that we're going through this elitism. The second thing is our system of government is more, and this is where I like the Europeans a little better. In America, we are more and more money driven. You cannot get into a Senate from California unless you have $100 million. What? Mm-hmm. Is this government of the people for the people? No. What people have $100 million to get into Senate? You want to get the president, you have to spend about $3 billion with a B. $3 billion to get into the White House. That's a lot of money. So it's got to come from somewhere. And guess what? I, as the donut shop guy, don't have the money to give them, but the Facebook does. And nobody gives something without an expectation of something in return.
No.
So because the system is based on money, the bigger you get, you can inject that money. And when you inject that money, you can expect some privileges. You become the elite.
Yep.
Right? So this is the system is kind of messed up. Now, do I believe that smaller companies are going to be coming? There is a cycle, and I think we're in a cycle of new generation of small companies to come up. Why? Because all of those people who made $500,000 at Facebook, the 12,000 at Google that got laid off, the people at different places that are getting laid off, these are smart people. They didn't get to be dumb when they left. They are the ones who make the products for all these big companies. And then they come out, and this time they have money. They've been making $500,000, $1 million, $300,000 a year. All of their stock options have worth something.
But what if... And you know that as an investor, if your strategy, your out strategy is to be bought, you're getting out from the big company, you build a company, and then you want the bigger company to get and incorporate you again. So the big fish just get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Again, let's go back to why that is, because we are in a society that we want the big money, and that's everybody wants to be Mark Zuckerberg, right? But there are other options that structurally you can develop. Here's the thing. Why is it that Elon Musk has got somewhere around $2 billion worth of subsidies? Now, if you have a business, can you get that? Nope. You can't get that. So the structure of helping, and if you go to a bank and you want to get a business loan, They undress you, and they, you know, somebody says they want your great-great-grandfather to come in and vouch for you. But if you take a Donald Trump or the Kennedy family or the Rockefeller family, they could go in there without anything and get loans over nothing.
Sid, you know what my grandfather used to say? The bank give you the umbrella when it doesn't rain.
Yes. That's exactly true. But to you and I, they give the umbrella when it's not raining.
Well,
to the people that can move the stuff, they give the umbrella anytime because they know they can manipulate the system to to do that. No, again, I'm not trying to be political, but if you take take our president, he has bankruptcy four times. Okay, now, and they gave him $800 million, and the argument by the bank is, I can bet on this guy. He is too big to fail, and he's going to come back. But you, as an owner of a 7-Eleven, you're not too big to fail.
Yeah.
So why would I give it to you? There is logic there. So there's nothing wrong with Trump getting it or the likes of Trump and others. There's nothing wrong with the banks making that argument. The system is designed like that.
Yeah, and again, I mean, this is not a political position because we can do the same conversation if you're looking at somebody on the left. I mean, the amount of money that you take to run for president is the same for both. So, but it's important that we point out this thing because it's the system.
Just to double down on what you said.
Yeah.
This what I'm describing is if you're running for the senator in California, you need $100 million. All of the candidates are almost all Democrats. Where are they getting these $100 million?
How many people do we have? It's a system. It's a system.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Now, so, the system is designed this way. So there's a problem with the system.
So this is where we're going to do the last few minutes because we're already at 39 and that's cool. Again, I want you back because I want to have this conversation more. Do we see with your transition from physical to mental to improving everybody's in a very idealistic society, whatever it is, utopian, whatever you want to call it, that with the right education, the right redefinition, who knows when, who knows how, we could get to that level of, become enlightened, like I'm going to go back to Renaissance or anything like that, where we can put, again, instead of the money, the well-being of people, and we all make decision based on that because that's the real value and not actually the money. Because money, as they say, doesn't necessarily buy happiness. So what is happiness? Having the bank full or being healthy and happy?
So I have a very good friend of mine, Marty Cooper. He is literally the inventor of cell phone. He's 90-some odd years old. And he and I have these interesting conversations. I mean, I say that it's like talking to Einstein. And he says, Sid, you and I are too optimistic, but we like it this way. I am optimistic because I like to be optimistic as opposed to pessimistic. It feels better to be optimistic.
Yeah.
I am optimistic that we've gone through all these generations and all these tens of thousands of years, and we are here because at some point we evolved in a certain direction. Could we have made some better decisions? Would we have been in a better place? Perhaps. But we are at the edge, at the very beginning of a new era. I believe that this new era is also going to be an evolutionary era for us. It's not just technology. This is not an issue of technology. This is like we had fire and then we didn't have fire. It changed the way we eat. It changed the way we lived. It changed a lot of stuff. We now have realized that the life could be a lot better, and we're realizing it more and more. We can use these tools and these technologies to make our life better. The first time an AI is used in some form or shape to cure cancer, one type of a cancer, guess what? Everybody is going to be, hallelujah.
And he's already doing it.
You know, there is something. So the point is this. I am optimistic about the direction. I am not today optimistic about people realizing that direction and being on board for the same fear reasons that we discussed and for all the other media and corporates and all of those things that surrounds the discussions, the controlling, our mindset, our privacy laws, our regulations, all of that sort of stuff, are impediments to the speed at which we are going to get to a place. I think it's a 100-year cycle. I don't think this is going to happen within my lifetime. Now, you asked me if I have something to sell or why am I here? Why do I do these podcasts and why do I write these articles and why do I write books? Because I want to help provoke people. I don't want to motivate them. Nobody can motivate anybody to do anything. That's nonsense. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not you. But I like to provoke you to say, hey, do you want your kids to live in a better life? Get with it. Do you want to be able to buy that home and that comfort in 5-10 years? The boat, the train is leaving the station. Get on board now. Mm-hmm. This is the time not to be afraid.
Yep.
You may have been afraid to get married some point, but you did. You got on the train. Hey, this is you got to accept this change, because yeah, change is our best friend. Change is what provides us with options. Marco, if there was no change, you would be eating the same thing every day, doing the same thing every day. If you have a kid, that 5-year-old would always stay 5-year-old, never get married, never go anywhere.
And probably we would have a lifespan of, I don't know, 18 years instead of whatever we have.
Change, listen, is your best friend. Let me leave it with that.
And I'm going to take that and I'm going to finish connecting the fact that I share your objective, because Redefining Society, even in the name, if people haven't get it, it's optimistic. It's asking a lot of questions, make people think and see if we can. I don't have answer, but I have a lot of questions. And I think people need to question a little bit more what they read, what they've been told, and use their brain and common sense. So I hope that people listening to this longer than usual episode will be leaving with some question, leave some comments if they want to, and hopefully to subscribe and stay tuned, because Sid, if you would like to, I would love to talk more with you in the future. And if you want to come back, we can pick another topic or just go from where we left it here.
Sure. Be happy to. Be happy.
All right. Thank you so much for your time. And thanks everybody for following. Stay tuned for, I guess, other interesting conversations. So if you like that, this is the place. Take care, everybody.
Bye.
Take care, Sid.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impacts of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Redefining Society podcast, hosted by Marco Ciappelli. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then take a moment to rate this show and add it to your favorite podcast player. Subscribe to our YouTube channel and share this episode with your friends, family, and colleagues. We invite you to come back for more stories and follow Marco Ciappelli on his social media as he continues this journey into the future of our societies.
Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSP Mag 24.